Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up on this edition, including the Israeli businessman encouraging his staff to strike.
I'm very active in protest. I was out protesting last night till well past midnight. We are protesting tonight. We'll continue protesting for a long time, I presume, until it works.
We'll look at the economic impact of those strikes. And when should you retire? We're going to hear from one of Britain's most famous actors. But we're going to start the programme by talking about the US elections, about 2 months to go till the presidential elections. And we want to look at the amount of money that is being spent on them, because it's billions of dollars. We're going to try and put an exact figure on that in a few minutes' time. It's not easy to do. But we wanted to hear from a donor about why they want to give their hard-earned money to politicians. Eric Levine is a New York bankruptcy lawyer and a supporter of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think it's a way to give back. You could be involved in the political process. It's a democracy. Democracies only work if the electorate participates. And donating to candidates who share your values, I think, is probably the best way to participate. I mean, some people give back to the country, like my son served in the Marines, but I never had the opportunity to serve in the military. So being politically active is my way of giving back. And the Republican Party, certainly the Reagan wing of the Republican Party, where I am, is, I think, the best solution for America's problems and the best path forward. And so I'm working very hard to help those candidates in that wing of the party.
Can I ask you, when you're talking about the Republican Party, then let's be very clear here as we move towards the presidential election. Are you donating money to the Republican Party? Are you donating money specifically to the Trump campaign? Which one is it?
I have not contributed any money to the Trump campaign. I've focused my attention primarily on the United States Senate, because it's far from certain that Trump is going to win. I hope he does, but he may not. And if he doesn't, then it's critical that the Republicans retake the Senate.
You don't seem to be such a big fan of Donald Trump. And is that what stops you giving money to his campaign? You know, you said recently he was trying to lose after some of his political appointments.
First, let's make sure you are correct in what I said. I think you misrepresented a little bit what I have said. I didn't say that he was trying to lose. What I said was, I am concerned that by attracting other candidates like RFK and endorsements from people like Tulsi Gabbard, who I believe are kind of on the fringe, he is taking time away from focusing on where most of the voters are, and that's in the political center. I'm a former Nikki Haley supporter, and I think it's important for Republicans to win. We need Reagan Republicans, independents, women, and potentially some moderate Democrats. And my concern is that if he spends too much time worrying about bringing in people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. or Tulsi Gabbard, who's a former Bernie Sanders supporter, that he's not spending enough time and focusing enough on those votes in the center.
That is interesting, though, isn't it? Because at the moment, if you look at a lot of the figures, it does seem that Kamala Harris is getting more money than the Trump campaign, and particularly from individual donors as well. Do you think that is because she's more at the center than he is?
Well, that's insane. She is radical left. That's part of the lie here.
But why is she getting more money then?
First of all, it's not the question of who has the most money. It's whether or not you have enough money. And Donald Trump will have enough money. And I think over the span of the campaign so far, I think in total, he's raised more than she has. It's just in this finite period of time, she has raised more money.
On this issue of donations, the simple fact is we had J.D. Vance recently, didn't we, who is the running mate of Donald Trump, appealing to the likes of Peter Thiel to to put more money into the campaign. He said we need more money coming into the campaign. What is stopping people putting money into the campaign who are Republican supporters like yourself?
Trump has raised millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I'm not going to speak for anyone else. For someone like myself, I'm not a billionaire. I don't have incredible wealth. So I can just focus my attention in one area. Some of the bigger donors can donate to Trump. And the idea that she's a moderate, that's also just a fallacy. She's actually the fringe. She's used to be for an open border and against a wall. Now, all of a sudden, she's for a closed border and for a wall. She used to be against fracking. But now, all of a sudden, she knows that she needs Pennsylvania to win. So now she's against fracking.
Can I just get back to the money for a minute here? And you've spoken very eloquently about why you want to give and some of the views that you hold. On a more general view, isn't there too much money in the US political system at the moment? Do you not think it's getting slightly out of hand when you look at the billions of dollars that are spent on presidential and political campaigns?
The answer to that is really no, because if you look historically, whoever has the most money doesn't necessarily win. Do we have a President Hillary Clinton? Obviously not.
No, but you need to be able to have a lot of money to be able to even stand, don't you?
You need a certain amount, but you don't necessarily, it's not necessarily the candidate that raises the most. And Trump will have enough. He'll have enough money to get. The question is how he will use it and how he will get his message out. There's not going to be any doubt he's going to have enough money to run a robust and complete 50-state campaign. And on the key issues of the border, crime, taxes, and the economy, the American people are overwhelmingly with the Trump policies and reject the Harris policies.
Okay, well, we'll have to see. We'll see. We'll find out, won't we, who is in the overwhelming majority there. Last question to you. You're not a billionaire. You said that to us before, but you are a wealthy man. I mean, you're not going to tell us exactly how much money you give, but you give, I presume, in the millions.
You would presume wrong. I've raised money in the millions, but I don't give money in the millions. I don't know how you define a wealthy man. I mean, compared to the world at large, I consider myself very fortunate. I've raised a couple million dollars, but I have not contributed nearly that amount of money. I'm just a single guy out there trying to do my patriotic duty and be part of the process.
You sound quite contented. You feel that that's money that's well spent being part of that political system.
As Winston Churchill said, it's the worst system in the history of the world, bar all others. So I'm very proud to be an American. I'm very proud of the American political process. And I'm proud to be a part of it.
Listening to Eric Levine is Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Larry, thanks so much for joining us on World Business Report.
Sure.
Do we know, is it possible to know how much money has been raised already for these U.S. elections?
No, we know what the floor is, and the floor is already well over $1 billion with the two presidential candidates and their affiliated committees added together. But of course, that's a dramatic underestimate. It will be billions and billions and billions by November 5th, just in the presidential race. You'll have additional billions, obviously, for the Senate and the House and all the state legislative candidates, right down to sheriff.
Where is all this money coming from? Because I think there's sort of different groups, aren't there? Is it from rich, wealthy Americans, or is it from individual donors?
Well, all of the above. Obviously, the very wealthy, and I don't know what Mr. Levin's actual net worth is, but we've got a group of billionaires in both parties, although they seem to be concentrating more on the Republican side this year, who are giving enormous amounts. Now, Elon Musk has pledged apparently $45 million per month to the Trump constellation of committees. I don't know whether he's delivering on that or not. But we've had other billionaires on the Republican side suggesting that $10 million a semester, $10 million a month or more is perfectly reasonable. But let's remember that in the end, most of the money will actually come from medium-sized and low-sized donors. What do I mean by medium? Medium would be thousands and thousands of dollars over the course of a campaign. But it's the little donor who really matters, the one who gives $10, $25, or $50, or $100, and may repeat that two or three times during the campaign. That adds up, and it's those people who do the work of the campaign. They've got skin in the game. When they give a little bit of money, they will work very, very hard in the evenings and on weekends, and that's what makes a winning campaign.
Well, let us see who ends up winning that particular campaign. It was interesting that Eric Levine was quite clear that he didn't think it was about the money in deciding the election. Is that a fair comment?
I actually agree with him on that, and here's why. Both sides will have all the money they need times 100. We have an unlimited source of money. We have the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, and you know, one ocean funds each of these candidates. It's a bottomless pit. I'm always amazed at how much money is out there, and it goes way up every 4 years.
Okay, but where does it go? I mean, why do you need so much money? Is it all going on ads? Where do they spend all this cash?
Well, they spend a great deal of it on television or the various television stations and media markets, and that ranges across a wide variety. But you also have digital advertising. You have organization at the local level, which produces voter turnout. I think that's the best use of money. And with the campaigns have finally realized that and are spending hundreds of millions of dollars just to get out their voters. You're not going to persuade many people anymore in America. They're either Democrats or Republicans. They're either for Trump or they're for Harris. But you have to find them. It was Abraham Lincoln in the 1850s who said, find them and vote them. And that's the secret to winning a campaign.
Stay with us. I want to bring in George Conboy, chairman of Brighton Securities. George, we've heard about who's donating there. And it seems to be individuals rather than companies that are giving money. Is that what you're getting a sense of?
I believe that's true. It's primarily individuals, as Larry Sabato says, from the smallest to the largest nationwide.
Why do you think businesses don't want to get involved? You know, is that because if you pick the wrong side, it might affect your business?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Or at least it's the fear of that, Rahul. The idea that we have very much 50-50 polarization and you don't want to offend whatever might be that other side of where you're donating. Businesses prefer to stay out of that fray.
Larry, let's put you on the spot. Who would like to do that on World Business Report? I know we can't. We're sort of guesstimating how much has been spent so far. Give us your sense of how much will be spent in the end.
Well, I'm counting the super PACs, and the campaigns don't control them, but they spend the money as the campaigns wish because they read their websites and they have a pretty good idea of where to spend the money. I would say somewhere between 10 and 12 billion just for the presidential candidates, 10 and 12 billion.
12 billion, right. We're going to come back to you at the end of this campaign and see how accurate you are there. But thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating to hear your views there. The super PACs are sort of indirect ways that people can fund political campaigns in the US. Lots of money flowing into that. Let's talk, George, about somebody who we know is giving money to the election campaign. That's Elon Musk. But he's having problems in Brazil with X, isn't he? That was banned. That's now been upheld by judges there as well. How much of a problem is that for his company?
The jury's still out how much of a problem it is, although certainly many X users appear to be migrating to other platforms. Tremendous, tremendous advertising. There's an old saying that any press you can get where you're not in handcuffs is good press, and he's not in handcuffs yet. So that may still turn out okay. There aren't many jurisdictions around the world that have banned Twitter. But in addition to Brazil, I think we could count China, North Korea, Iran, for example. So I'm not sure Brazil is an illustrious company in this regard.
No, it probably isn't. Is it easy to work out what's going on with X now, particularly as it's gone private?
It's a lot harder now. We don't have those kind of financial metrics every 90 days that we used to have. One plus there for Twitter, in addition to not having to report so frequently, is that they have the enormous resources of Elon Musk's individual personal wealth if he chooses to keep devoting it to keeping that system up and running. So that's okay. A big plus for them.
Yeah, definitely. Right. We talk a lot, don't we, about some of the world's big car companies on World Business Report. Let's talk about Volkswagen. Possible factory closures in Germany. What does that tell us about the car industry? And here's a company that's really banking on electric cars.
Right. It's a serious, serious matter. I believe that Volkswagen has not closed a facility, production facility in Germany since the 30s. So this would be a huge, huge deal. I don't think they've closed one worldwide in nearly 20 years. They need a lot of money for the move to electric, and they're looking to cut costs by about $10 billion. And naturally, the German economy has relatively high labor rates. So the big bet on electric, they're hoping it will pay off, but it can be a problem for some of the German unions, which are fairly militant unions. This one really bears watching.
Yeah, we will keep a close eye on that. Now, the trial of Martin Winterkorn, who is the former VW CEO who was embroiled in the emissions scandal, well, that is due to start in Germany on Tuesday. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
That's the sound of people chanting on the streets of Tel Aviv, Israel's financial capital, demanding the government double down on efforts to free the remaining hostages taken last October. Well, what started with protests has evolved into sporadic strikes across the country on Monday, affecting much of it. However, later in the day, the Tel Aviv Labor Court ordered an end to the strike. Peter Lerner is a spokesperson for the Histadrut Union.
We went into this strike with the knowledge that the government would try and curtail it. We understand that it makes them feel uncomfortable. I would say we hope that they put as much effort in bringing the hostages home with an agreement as they did in trying to stop the strike. The court injunction, actually, it's a preliminary stage. So we may be looking at pursuing more organizing steps and more strike action in the future.
This evening in Israel, the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, well, he's been appealing to the public for their continued support.
I am begging for your forgiveness that we did not succeed bringing them home alive. We were very close, nearly there. And I would like to repeat once again this evening, Israel will not move onto our normal agenda after that massacre. Hamas will pay a very heavy price for it.
We wanted to hear from a business that has had workers involved in the strike. Ofer Doron is the founder and chief exec of the Israeli EV engine startup, EVR Motors, based in the Tel Aviv suburbs. He's been speaking to my colleague, Will Bain.
I've encouraged my workers to go and protest, but not all are protesters. So those that aren't protesting work, and those who want to participate in protest, I've encouraged them to take the day off. We pay them, and we're happy to have them protest.
So you're still open, still working as a company, but encouraging
partially
any staff who want to go and protest.
Exactly, exactly. But many other companies are closed. Much of the government is closed. The airport's barely working. The trains and buses are working only partially. There are a lot of roadblocks by the protesters in many different areas, often by surprise.
Why have you made that decision? Why have you encouraged your staff to protest?
Because the future of our country depends on ridding us of our very radical government. And specifically at this stage, the strategy of our prime minister to lengthen the war just so he can stay in power.
You've spoken to us before kindly on the program, Ofer, about the economic backdrop, you know, more difficult for, you're seeing fewer people come to visit you to inquire about new inquiries for business, that kind of stuff. Does a massive nationwide strike, well-meaning as the reasons might be, not exacerbate what's already a pretty difficult economic situation?
In the very, very short term, yes. But the government is spending huge amounts of money on the wrong things. And if we don't put a stop to it, the economy, we see this in the credit ratings that are going down. We see this in the huge deficit that is not only the result of the military operations. We see this in problems with investments. We see this across the board. And so the only real solution is to put in place a government that will run the economy the right way. And it's not this government, unfortunately.
Have you continued to see that chilling effect on investment?
Absolutely. It goes up and down. Visits are down because flights have been cancelled again after the last threats from Iran and Lebanon.
How much pressure is that putting on your business?
It's putting pressure on the business. It took me 20 hours to fly to India instead of a six-hour direct flight that's been cancelled a few weeks ago. So I pay a bit of a toll. My staff pays a bit of a toll. Not always optimal, but we manage.
Ofer Daron, the Israeli businessman. And the Israeli government has said it's disappointed by Britain's decision to suspend some arms exports to Israel that was announced a short while ago. Let's move over now to a different continent because the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has given his final annual report before leaving office and has defended his economic record. Here he is speaking to a crowd of supporters in Mexico City.
During this six-year term, we displaced China and Canada, and today we are the United States' leading trading partner. The peso has not been devalued for the first time in more than 50 years. On the contrary, our currency is the second strongest in the world in relation to the dollar.
In October, Mr. Obrador, who's universally known by his initials, AMLO, will hand over to Claudia Sheinbaum. She'll become Mexico's first female president. Well, I've been speaking to Vanessa Rubio Marquez, a former Mexican deputy finance minister. I asked her how important it is to be the number one trading partner of the U.S.
It is a very important position, of course, but one that, as I was saying, is structural because it was a decision that was made by joining NAFTA back in the 1990s. And now the evolution into USMCA has got us to this point. Also, the sort of global trends in relation to nearshoring and other aspects have resulted in this. So I would say that is a more structural situation and feature of the Mexican economy. But there's two elements that I always underscore. One is the public debt, and this is the historic public borrowing sector requirements. And when AMLO began his term back in 2018, the debt to GDP ratio in Mexico was 43.2%. And now he leaves it with 51%. So the country is more indebted now. They still are running a very high debt and a very high fiscal deficit this year. Fiscal deficit the year before was 3%, and this year is 5.9%.
Can I ask you why you think that is the case then? Is it to do with investments that have been made into the country? Why has the debt increased so much?
The debt has increased due to a number of reasons. The first one is projects that have been pursued during this administration. One is an oil refinery that is yet to produce barrels of oil. And the other is a Maya train in the Yucatan Peninsula that is another of the big projects of this administration. And also the fact that if you were standing in 2018, the expenditure for social programs, the transfers for social programs was $8 billion, and today is $30 billion this year. And the other is that basically the government also has made a series of choices. In the last year, expenditure increased from 3% of public deficit to 6% of public deficit, and it was an electoral year, 2024. It was the presidential election.
It's interesting you raised the point there about the oil refinery that was being built. Mexico is an economy that is still based, isn't it, to a large extent on fossil fuels. It's the 11th biggest producer of oil in the world. But his replacement, Claudia Sheinbaum, she is somebody who has a real background in the impact of climate change. Do you think that she will move Mexico more towards renewables?
Yes, that's part of the program that she's pursuing. It is, of course, yet to be seen once she's in power, the constraints and the tailwinds that she has to put that proposal into practice. Of course, one of the constraints will be growth. Economic growth in 2018 throughout the previous administration had been at an average of 2.2%. That is well below Mexico's potential. But today, we are growing over the last 6 years at an average of 0.8, 0.9%. So she needs to pick up growth. She needs to improve productivity. The factors of productivity are essential. So education, training, health, and other elements that will need to be invested in order for productivity to pick up in the country and thus growth as well.
Does she need to get the private sector more involved? Because AMLO didn't allow the private sector, did he, to get involved in Mexico's electricity sector. Will she have to change those policies if she wants to get the country more reliant on renewables?
Absolutely, yes. She will need the private sector very much because, of course, investment and job creation comes from the private sector. Of course, the public sector leads the way and creates incentives and regulate, but the right balance of incentives towards the private sector in order for them to invest more in the country is exactly key to what Claudia Sheinbaum needs to do when she begins governing Mexico as of October this year, and to pick up growth and to pick up development that is a must.
Let us be honest, though. If he had been able to stand again, and the way that Mexico's constitution works, he couldn't stand for a second term as president, AMLO would have won very easily. He's going out of office with an incredibly 76% popularity rating, which seems to indicate that economically Mexicans were happy with him.
Yes, definitely. When social expenditure is $8 billion and you start spending $30 billion in a year, of course people would like that. And when you increase by decree almost 150% the minimum wage, that is also, of course, something that people will like. The issue here is that they will have to pay for this. Mexico will have to pay for this in the coming years. So that's why the equation now is pointing towards a lot of pressures in terms of expenditure, in terms of budget, and in terms of debt.
Vanessa Marquez there on AMLO, who is standing down. Some would say retiring, I suppose, to some extent. And that is where we're going to end the programme. It is an issue that has caused lots of discussion for governments in countries like France, where their attempts to change the retirement age has led to huge protests. But it's also a very personal decision. The actor Ian McKellen, known for his role in Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings franchise, has told the BBC that 85, he's no plans to retire. He fell off stage earlier this year during a theatre production in London. Tim Moffat has been speaking to him.
It was a shock. It wasn't that I'd got dizzy or anything like that. It was a pure accident. So I count myself lucky that it's beginning to be a distant memory.
I mean, your work ethic has been revered within the industry and beyond for many, many years. Has it made you reassess that at all?
Oh, I don't think it's that I've got an ethic. It's what else would I be doing if I wasn't working? I shall take the rest of the year off and then get back to work in January. Just keep at it as long as the legs and the lungs and the mind keep working. I forget names. And, of course, when you say that to somebody, they say, oh, me too. And you think, well, is it the human condition? And does one at one's mid-80s know too many names? When you're older, you've got more to remember than people who are young. Nevertheless, it's a nuisance when you can't remember your best friend's name, you know.
George, got a number in mind for retirement for yourself? I'm sure it's a long way away.
84. They say, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. So if I'm not working, maybe I'll never retire.
Well, that is true. And I'm forgetting names. So George, somebody, thanks very much for joining us. That was World Business Report.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.